Facebook live stream going, but at some point you just have to say, you know, it's a radio show, so maybe the whole radio portion of it takes precedence. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can join the conversation at 651-989-5855. I throw that number out there just so that you have it. We probably won't actually open up the lines until much later in the program tonight because we have not one, but two guests in studio with us tonight. We have our now usual, we can say usual guest, Pastor Nathan Roberts, in with us for a Thursday evening.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
And we also have Pastor Obi Bollinger. Did I get that correct? Bollinger in with us.
Bollinger,
and,
yep.
And we're going to get to your perspective on the back, going all the way back to 2012, the attempt to put a ballot measure on, well, it was on the ballot,
yep,
to amend the Constitution to ban gay marriage. And you were involved in the effort to oppose that, which we all know was successful. And a lot has happened since then. And it seems like ancient history at this point. But there's much to discuss in terms of retrospective on that issue and how we move forward as a culture, as a society in the state. And so that's going to be a fascinating conversation when we get to it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Appreciate you being in studio with us tonight. We're going to start off, though, talking about, since we have Nathan with us, and you know you reside in Minneapolis, this story from over the weekend where a police precinct in North Minneapolis had a display, a Christmas tree display, that has been described by the mayor of all people and others as being racist. And I want to get your perspective on this. We talked a little bit about this last night, and I'm particularly interested in your perspective on it as someone who lives in that area and has a sense of, you know, what people are thinking and feeling about it. What is your sense of the impact that this story has had, Nathan?
Yeah, so I think it's functioning on a couple levels. One, there's the dynamic of interpersonal, whether this is a joke, an over-response, if it's racist, if it's racialized. There's also the ongoing dynamic between the people of Minneapolis and Minneapolis City Police, particularly on the north side. And then there's this other level where Jacob Fry and Jeremiah Ellison are responding on a political level. And looking to respond in ways that maybe Mayor Betsy Hodges did not respond or did respond. I think a lot of her mayorship was seen through the prism of her response to North Minneapolis and the killing of Jamar Clark. And I think Jacob Fry saw that and is trying to respond very differently. And so there's a lot going on, I think, on those different layers, and people are having conversations.
So let's take them one at a time. First of all, in terms of the perception of the incident itself, and to get our description, you know, for in case somebody happened to miss it, from the Star Tribune, two Minneapolis police officers have been placed on leave pending an internal affairs investigation into what Mayor Jacob Fry called a racist display in the form of Christmas tree decorations in the Northside precinct. The incident occurring in a precinct where police leaders have struggled to rebuild community trust since the fatal shooting of Jamar Clark in 2015 was quickly denounced Friday as a provocative insult. Longtime civil rights activist John Edwards called the 4th Precinct tree decorations, which were a Newport cigarette pack, a can of Steel Reserve malt liquor, police tape, a bag of Takis, and a cup from Popeye's Louisiana Chicken, a wink wink to racist stereotypes. It's a modern day version of a dog whistle tainted with racism, specifically against the African American community, Edwards said. So, you know, given that that's the nature of what it is, when that's an objective description of what the decorations, quote unquote, were on the Christmas tree. To your mind, it seems as though there's some debate over whether or not this was actually intended to be racist or was intended to be a joke.
Yeah, so I think one of the major dynamics is if you don't understand, anytime you tell a joke, you're taking a risk. And sure. That's what makes it funny.
Right.
It's a risk. And also, you don't tend to tell jokes in family situations that are not working, in jobs that the relationships have broken down. There's not a lot of opportunity for risk-taking in that dynamic anymore. The dynamic between the North Side police officers and the North Side community. And so what it showed me is that these police officers don't understand the dynamic very well, clearly. Because that's a big part of a joke. If it is, in fact, a joke, is that you understand your audience. Mm-hmm. Clearly, they did not. Secondly...
Well, I mean, let me just pause you there. Because do you think that the audience was the broader public? Or that what they did in the relative privacy, granted, you know, it's their workplace, so it's not private. But in the relative, it's not as though they, you know, they streamed it on Facebook for everyone to see. This was something that they put up for other police officers to see. And in that context, you know, based on those relationships that they have with each other, they thought it would be funny, presumably. They thought it would be funny amongst themselves and never intended it to be something that was going to be observed and debated amongst the broader community.
Yeah, and I think that goes to, again, showing these police officers might not be qualified for this job. If they don't understand that the police officer's Christmas tree is going to be viewed by the public, and that's mm-hmm. going to be a reflection on their judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of police officers don't live in Minneapolis. You know, they live right. other places.
Right.
And I don't know, maybe Christmas trees with stereotypes on them might fly in other neighborhoods, but it's not going to fly in Minneapolis. And if you don't understand that, I mean, I'm kind of surprised that there's even a Christmas tree up in a police station in Minneapolis, like a government building. You know, I think in schools, we've almost completely moved away from that. And so if you have a Christmas tree up, you're kind of already flirting close to the line. And then to use that Christmas tree, which also I just think as... Well,
That's interesting, because if there was some other, you know, if it was a different time of year and there was some other contextually appropriate religious observation from a more minority religion, say Islam or Judaism or Hinduism or whatever the case may be, would you have the same concern?
I think if you start taping garbage to a religious symbol, you're on thin ice.
No, I agree, but just the symbolism period, like the fact that, because you brought up the idea of having a Christmas tree is inherently provocative to some extent. Would it be equally provocative if it were some other religious display, or is it just that it's a Christmas tree?
I think for me, regardless of what religious background, it would have been in poor taste. It's in poor taste to put garbage on a religious symbol. It's in poor taste to use that garbage that is associated with the poor and with some of the challenges, maybe, and also just things that people like in that neighborhood to kind of make a mockery of them a little bit. I think it just shows that you don't have some of the basic judgment you need to have to be walking the streets of North Minneapolis if you're going to be making these kind of unforced errors at the home front.
So I think, you know, that's one of three different areas that you wanted to explore regarding this issue. And honestly, you know, perhaps there's some debate amongst our listeners regarding whether or not this was in poor taste or in poor judgment or whether or not it shouldn't have happened. To my mind, I think you're going to have to search far and wide for somebody who thinks this is great, this is wonderful, or it's A-okay, or it's acceptable in any way. Setting that aside, there are two other aspects of this story that you wanted to cover. The one being the I'm trying to come to my I might be skipping ahead to the Well, perhaps you recall.
Yeah, the political dynamics between Jacob Frey and Jeremiah Ellison.
Sure.
This was, in my mind, a way to clearly differentiate their administration from Betsy Hodges' administration.
Mm-hmm.
Betsy Hodges was late to the party with the wrong bottle of wine on everything that happened with Black Lives Matter.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
You know, everything she did added to the problems.
Mm-hmm.
She never really showed up and things got better, in my opinion. I was at a few of the protests in North Minneapolis. I was also on the freeway when 94 was shut down, surrounded by police officers. And for me, it was about standing in the freeway and saying, because of the way the highways are set up, that you can literally drive around North Minneapolis. You never have to go to North Minneapolis unless you live there mm-hmm. or work there.
Mm-hmm.
And the protest for me was about, you can't keep driving around the problems in North Minneapolis. So we're going to stop you in traffic and say, look, you need to stop and look at this. And in that way, I think it was a very effective protest. Now, some people think, you know, you shouldn't stop traffic, but those people are also more than happy to turn my neighborhood into a parking lot every Vikings game. So I don't understand really if it really is about traffic, but people say it was. But I think Jacob Frey also bit off a little more than he could chew, because he asked for the people to be fired, and then kind of it seems like he didn't have that authority.
Well, he clearly didn't. And that's the aspect of the story. You know, we talked about this last night. Yeah, you know, to my mind, what's interesting about this story, you know, there's a couple of things had gone just a little bit differently, I wouldn't even have talked about it on the air, because to me, there's nothing particularly controversial about condemning what these police officers did. It was clearly inappropriate. They shouldn't have done it. They should face disciplinary action. I don't have any problem with them facing disciplinary action. What I find interesting is the disparity in the sense of urgency that is commanded by this type of scenario versus the complete lack of urgency that's shown in other situations that, in my judgment, would warrant at least as much, if not more, urgency. It seems as though if you want to get specifically politicians and government officials to jump and get something done, to really get proactive, then have it be about something that has to do with race, or have something to do with social justice, or, you know, some sort of perceived disparity or discrimination or mistreatment. Like, in our culture, for whatever reason, this has become like the number one concern that supersedes literally everything else. Somebody's offended and they're of the right protected class. Therefore, stop the presses. All of our attention has to be focused on this. To the point where you have somebody in a position of authority like the mayor of Minneapolis who doesn't even pause. Like, he didn't even stop to make a phone call to ask somebody what's going on. What's my authority? What are our options? He just went straight to Twitter or wherever he expressed this, or in front of the nearest camera, and said, they're fired, without any sort of vetting of whether or not that was even an option. Like, it seems kind of reckless to me and it seems like an invited recklessness, perhaps in the context of the perceived inadequacy of the Hodges administration to respond to things, that it's kind of given a green flag to just say or do whatever in response to the drop of a hat of something being offensive to certain groups.
Yeah, I also think that two things. One, I think that shouting about a racist action is free. Like, you don't have to spend any money to fix North Minneapolis if you shout about a Christmas tree. It's not an expensive way to address racism. That's not to say it's not an important way to address racism, because I think it's important to acknowledge where we're at in the types of people that are getting through the vetting process of being hired in North Minneapolis police officers. So I think that's something to point at. I also think that when it comes to scoring political points, he did something interesting by overstepping, because he also somewhat signaled that he didn't really trust the process.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, he doesn't trust that this person is going to get fired if they should be fired.
Mm-hmm.
He's jumping in. And when you jump in like that, what you sort of say is, there might be something not right about the process.
So it's quasi-Trumpian in a sense. He's kind of just, you know, disregarding the rules in order to advance the cause of his constituency.
Well, one thing that was always troubling about, to me, about the nomination of Arredondo was when Betsy Hodges said that there was a systemic issue in policing. There was a systemic issue and that there was racism throughout the system and that there needed to be big changes. And then immediately hired the second in command and everybody took a step to the left. If you're not bringing in fresh people, if you're not bringing in all this other stuff, it's kind of hard to know how systemic was it if the second in command wasn't affected.
All right, we'll continue this conversation when we get on the other side of our break. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Pastor Nathan Roberts in with us. We're going to get in it with another pastor, Obi Bollinger, on a retrospective on the gay marriage issue and the status of the gay marriage and the culture and how we've adapted in the past few years when we come back. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Not sure what's going on with that morning show promo. It sounded quasi-satanic. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. In studio with Pastor Nathan Roberts, we've been talking about the controversy in North Minneapolis with the police precinct and their Christmas tree decorations, which were perceived to be racist in nature, and the reaction from Mayor Jacob Frey, which by all accounts, regardless of where you fall on the particulars of the issue, seems to have been premature and perhaps a little reckless in terms of him, you know, coming out and saying we're going to fire these guys and him having no authority to do so, not having really looked into the process of what it takes. And so the question, you know, for this short segment before we go to our bottom of the hour break and come back to get into a retrospective on gay marriage here in the state, the question seems to be what would have been the ideal response to this incident? And, you know, to my mind, and then we'll get Nathan's take on it, but to my mind, you know, this Christmas tree decoration situation and what the police officers involved did was objectively inappropriate. Like there is no scenario in any conceivable workplace where this type of behavior would be acceptable, right? Like it doesn't matter whether it's the police department or, you know, the nearest fast food joint. Like if you had done this, it would have been inappropriate to do and you would have faced some sort of disciplinary action for doing so. However, you know, when you're in a scenario, when you're in a position like mayor of Minneapolis, before you go off half-cocked talking about how you're going to fire the police officers involved, it just seems as though it would have been well advised for him to moderate his rhetoric just a little bit, to say, listen, I'm offended by this. Like, you could say that. Like, I'm personally offended by this. This strikes me as deeply inappropriate. We're going to investigate immediately. We're going to fast track the investigation, and if it turns out upon investigation to be what it appears to be, there will be the harshest possible consequences under the law and under the policy of the Minneapolis Police Department leveled against these officers. If he had said that would have been 100% true and 100% deliverable in terms of actually being able to execute upon it. Now, perhaps it wouldn't have been as provocative or satiating to certain activists within Minneapolis, but it would have had the virtue of being a little bit more mayoral, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's something that I've begun to notice as a pattern in this new mayor, having lived in Minneapolis, is he jumps quickly. He promised that the camp was going to be, there was going to be a new shelter built early this fall. That didn't come through. Seems to be jumping on timelines, declarations that he doesn't seem to be able to come through on. And I think that ebbs away at public trust.
Right.
Slowly but surely. So I think he's going to need to really work on that and get some people around him who can satiate his need to respond boldly and quickly.
Right.
While also saying things that are true.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not even that difficult. I mean, all you have to do is count. Like, you can be honest about how you feel about it, but when you talk about what you're going to do, you have to defer to process. You have to defer to, you know, what, where, and even something is just as simple as, I'm going to look into this and you're going to hear back from me shortly, with an emphasis on, this is going to be expedited. We're going to get on it quickly. And it's not going to be a week. It's not going to be a month. We're not going to let this die, but it's, I have to talk to people before I tell you what's going to happen, because I'm not the dictator of Minneapolis.
Yeah. And I think that ultimately builds trust with people. I think one of the things that we heard from Betsy Hodges a lot was that there was going to be responses to officers, to sure. protesters, sure. to police chiefs that never really came through.
Right.
And it just got dragged on and on and on. And in an over response, which I'm happy there's a response. I'm also happy that it was noted that there's an issue. I also think it's progress that people recognize that the relationship between the North Minneapolis police officers and their neighborhood is fraught. I think most people in the Twin Cities area now understand that as a dynamic, which prior to Jamar Clark, I don't know that people did. And so this is being put within a larger context of an ongoing dynamic in that neighborhood. And I think that people are beginning to wake up to that. And I think that's really important. How we begin to strategize about how to change that dynamic is a longer process that we're still figuring out.
All right. When we come back, we're going to bring in our second in studio guest, Pastor O.B. Ballinger, who is going to talk with us about his role in the opposition to the gay marriage amendment that was on the ballot in 2012. And we're going to get into Christian interpretation of scripture and, you know, all kinds of heavy, meaty stuff that is going to carry us through to for at least an hour and a half here on the program, and continue with our regular guest, Pastor Nathan Roberts. My name's Walter Atson. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. It is absolutely amazing how quickly the culture can change. You know, it was, what are we talking about, 2012? It's now almost 2019, so not even 10 years. Not even like 7 years since 2012, when we had a constitutional amendment on the ballot, a ballot measure that, if it had passed, would have codified the already existing, at the time, ban on gay marriage. And now, a mere, not even entirely 7 years later, it is inconceivable that we would ever go back. Absolutely, positively inconceivable that we would ever go back. And in fact, what was at the time a rock solid, totally uncontroversial position that marriage is defined as a union between one man and one woman has become something that, if you express it a little too aggressively, could potentially cost you your job, could get you deplatformed, could get you, you know, certainly shunned in certain circles. How does the culture change this quickly, this definitively, in such a polar opposite manner? We're going to get into that this evening with our guests in studio. Citing an article from CBS, in 2013, only 38% of Minnesotans supported same-sex marriage and 53% opposed it. 5 years later, in 2018, 67% support same-sex marriage. That is the extent to which hearts and minds have been changed on this subject. You know, and we're talking about people who, you know, are grown adults. You know, they say old dogs can't learn new tricks. There are a lot of old dogs who learned a new trick on this one. And so we're going to get into it with our two pastors in studio tonight. I'm going to turn our mic back over to Pastor Nathan Roberts, our regular guest who's in studio, for him to introduce our second guest. Go to it, Nathan.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I want to introduce a friend and colleague of mine, Pastor O.B. Ballinger, and he has been a real inspiration to me. We have known each other. We're both ordained in with the United Church of Christ. I'm serving in a Lutheran church right now. O.B. is at Edina Morningside UCC in the suburbs just outside Minneapolis. And he has been an amazing person in my life. We had the opportunity to serve at the school that I helped start in Kenya. He went and did relief work in Kenya, and that was an amazing opportunity for him to serve and give back. And I saw him as a leader and a pastor in that capacity. So I wanted to have him on and share his story with the listeners, and also a little bit about how hearts and minds have changed so much in the last 5 years. It's been amazing, and he was instrumental in working on the Marriage Amendment Act and did a lot of organizing work around that. So I'm going to introduce Pastor Obi Ballinger.
Thanks so much. I hope one day to live up to the esteem you have for me, Nathan. You're very generous. Yes, I am Obi Ballinger. I'm a pastor in the West Metro, and I'm a native Minnesotan, and have spent some time out in Montana in high school and on the East Coast for seminary, but very glad to be back now, almost 10 years in the land of my birth. And I'm happy to, I am less of a cultural curiosity now being a gay pastor than I used to be, but I'm happy to be here and to just share a little bit more about how I come to these parts of my identity and my calling. I feel called to be a pastor, and I feel called to live as a gay man in the world. And I think both are of God, and I'm called not just to be those things, but to serve God's people for good in the world, which is how you and I come to know each other in a number of different circumstances.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about how you grew up and your process of coming out and then coming to be a clergy?
Sure. I sometimes think that my most interesting years were the first 12 years of my life or so. I was born into a fundamentalist religious community that believed that it was the three dozen families or so in this place in southeastern Minnesota. We were the ones who were going to heaven, and everyone else just didn't get the revelation. So we virtually set our clocks by what the religious leader said. Whatever he said was correct and was the will of God. He had the ear of the angels and of Jesus directly. That kind of went by the wayside when I was a teenager. We left that community because it had become really abusive in a number of different situations, and my siblings and I were growing up and being able to see it more. So we left that, and my religious house of cards kind of fell apart. And I went looking for different faith communities. I felt drawn to be part of a community, and drawn to be with other folks who cared about deep, meaningful things. And so I did a little hop into Judaism, which is where my mom and my two younger sisters are today. I did a little skip through the Mormon faith, and then I jumped into the Lutheran faith when I was in high school. I was baptized as a sophomore in high school as a Lutheran kid, and I took to it like a duck to water. I was very active in the youth group, going every week, and then started helping to lead the youth group and then representing that on the church council. And when I found out my youth pastor could talk to people about God all day who actually cared about God and get paid for it, I wanted to sign up now. I wanted to do exactly what Pastor Darren did. And I ended up going where he went to college, and turned out to be a pastor like him. He was my first real pastor mentor. But by the end of my high school senior year, I knew that I was gay. And being an evangelical Lutheran kid, I was in Montana at the time, I knew that I wasn't supposed to be gay. And I prayed for over a year that this would be different, that God would take it away and make me different than I was. And I prayed and I prayed and I prayed. And then I had a moment kind of about this time of year in my senior year where I had this sense that it wasn't a voice or anything, but a sense of, if I haven't taken this away from you, it's not because I can't or don't have the power. It's because it's a gift. I want you to have it and discover it as a gift. And that was a turning point for me, a revelation, I would say. And in quick succession, Because of my origin, I'd learned kind of our family motto, to thine own self be true. And so when I came out to myself, I quickly came out to my grandmother, my mother, other parent, other folks. And the church turned out to not be a place that I could be myself. And I wasn't welcome there anymore. The group of friends that I was with, I was largely not welcome with them anymore. But I was leaving. I was going off to college. So I was okay with that, turning over a new leaf. And then I went to college, and 9/11 happened the second week I was in college. And I went looking for a church, and I stumbled into a United Church of Christ congregation that Sunday. And the preacher made sense, some sense of what was going on in the world, held it up against the hope of the gospel, and helped me understand my role as a Christian in this time. And I haven't looked back. The United Church of Christ has been my home ever since. And it's a home for people who have been many seekers in a lot of different traditions.
All right, that's a good place to pause it. We're due for a break. When we come back, I want to continue with your bio and sort of segue into, you know, your walk through recent history of, you know, this transition that's taking place in the culture, whereby, you know, as we stated at the top of the segment, just you know, less than a decade ago, it was less than a decade ago, Barack Obama was against gay marriage, right? Like, it's the flip that has taken place in the culture is so dramatic.
When I read that, I was shocked.
Yeah.
It felt like that can't be true.
But it is. And so we'll explore it when we come back with our guest in studio, Pastor Nathan Roberts and Pastor O.B. Bollinger, when we return. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Joined in studio tonight by our regular Thursday night guest, Pastor Nathan Roberts. And also, he brought along a friend, Pastor O.B. Bollinger, who is talking with us about his personal experience of having come out as a gay man within the church, and then going on to be a pastor and going on to be part of the political movement which opposed the 2012 effort to codify in the Minnesota State Constitution a ban on gay marriage, and turned just 6 months later into the legalization of gay marriage in this state in a dramatic cultural and political turn, a story for the ages, really, in terms of, I mean, the flip was just astounding in terms of opinion and legal status quo. I mean, there are very few things we can point to historically where opinion and legal circumstance have changed so quickly without like a violent revolution, without there being some sort of overthrow or coup or something along those lines. It's truly an astounding story. So in this last segment, this hour, I want, Obi, as best to your ability, to kind of complete your story, your account of, you know, starting off from where you left off, taking us through 2012 and through the past couple of years of your perspective on this shift in the culture. And then when we get on the other side of the break, we'll start to get into the debate regarding, you know, how conservatives perceive these things versus how progressives perceive these issues, and particularly within the context of Christianity, seeing as how you two are pastors and I myself identify as Christian. So without further ado, let's turn it back over to Obi to kind of pick off where you left off.
Thanks so much. So if you fast forward a few years, I am a pastor serving a local church in the United Church of Christ here in Minnesota. And I know, because I'm active publicly, I know about the growing steam behind the movement for a marriage amendment here in Minnesota, working to resist that. And the campaign that was formed, Minnesotans United for All Families, was formed in order to resist the marriage amendment, but it also recognized that we have to have a larger conversation about marriage equality as a whole. Like, we're not just talking about the bad thing of putting a ban in the state constitution. We're going to have a conversation all across Minnesota about marriage and who's in and who's out. And so we, on the campaign, and my congregation gave me a half-time leave to go work on the campaign. They loaned me to the campaign for that time. We had a conversation on the campaign, actually millions of conversations across the state, about what do we know about marriage? Marriage is a place for love and commitment and fidelity. Marriage is a place of till death do us part. And then we also asked people to reflect on who are the gay people in your life? Who are the people who are single or who are in partnered relationships? What are their lives like? Tell me their names. Who do you know? And then we invited people to think for themselves, could these people that I know, their stories, their hearts, their names, their lives, can I imagine them in commitments that are lifelong, faithful, committed, till death do us part? If I can, then why wouldn't we call that marriage? And that was the strategy of the campaign. It started with people of faith, and people of faith were at the heart of that campaign from start to finish. And there were a number of other noteworthy things about the campaign that I could speak to if the opportunity comes to. But it's really, I agree, it's been such a shift in public perception, but it's because we've asked people to stop thinking about gay marriage as kind of a phrase that elicits all sorts of emotions that have been attached to it, but instead we've asked people to think about the people you know. Who are the people you know and love and care about? Everyone knows people who are gay or lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and we invite folks then to consider, well, if marriage is good enough for these other folks that I know, why would we deny it to Uncle Jeff or Aunt Mabel? You know, we're going to invite everyone into these institutions of love and care and compassion and commitment.
Yeah, when I think back upon, my perspective on that campaign against the 2012 amendment that would have codified in the Constitution the ban on gay marriage, what struck me as a conservative and as, more of a libertarian leaning conservative was the embrace of what was effectively a libertarian message by the Minnesotans United for All Families. I mean, the slogan was the freedom to marry. It was a campaign for freedom, right? And in that sense, it was extraordinarily effective. And even though I personally was on the other side of the issue, and when we get back on the other side of 10 o'clock, we'll get into why that was and what my perspective was in debating the issue. But suffice it to say, I knew we were in trouble when that was the motto and that was the premise that you guys were utilizing, and it put the proponents of traditional marriage in a position of having to basically defend restriction and defend bans and defend keeping people from something that they wanted and what have you. And, when we get back on this at the break, we can get deeper into, why I feel as though that failed. But the one thing I'll say now before we go to break is what gives me hope about the future of our culture and the future of our state and our country is that such a message, the root message of liberty and freedom and having the ability to pursue your own values resonated with folks. The fact that that resonated with folks means that it can resonate in other areas and other applications, which is good for libertarians and it's good for folks like me. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Had the patience to sit through the first hour where we were being cordial and friendly with each other and introducing ourselves to each other. If you've been waiting for the fireworks to start, I don't know how much I don't know if we're going to charge across the table at each other and start throttling each other's throats or anything along those lines, but it is about to get a little bit heated in terms of at least having an argument on an intellectual level about gay marriage from the perspective of Christian theology and a retrospective on the politics surrounding the 2012 effort to pass a constitutional amendment that would have banned gay marriage, and reflecting upon how the culture has changed in the subsequent years so quickly, how the basically opinions have flipped, polling has flipped entirely in terms of how many people support gay marriage versus how many did less than a decade ago, lest we forget that personages such as Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were against gay marriage less than 10 years ago. And it would be unfathomable for either of them to say anything less than have 100% enthusiastic support for it today. So, you know, it's truly remarkable. And we're going to reflect upon it here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. Brad Omland taking your calls and producing the show. We will start taking your calls a little bit later in the hour at 651-989-5855. I want to take some time to kind of chew on this between the three of us here in the studio, the three of us being yours truly, Pastor Nathan Roberts, and Pastor Obi Lindger, who has some very relevant personal experience as a gay Christian pastor when it comes to this issue. So kind of picking up, you spent the first hour introducing yourself to us, Obi, and I appreciate Nathan, you bringing him in and kind of laying the groundwork for this. Now let's get into the meat of it, right? Like, and there's kind of two different avenues that we can go down here. One is the Christian theology avenue of what does the Bible have to say about homosexuality and about marriage. And then the other avenue is just kind of like the modern cultural phenomenon that has taken place over the next several years. And I'd like to talk about both of those things. But let's begin kind of with your personal experience. You mentioned in during the first hour when you're introducing yourself, Obi, that you attended a church at the time that you the way you phrased it was, came out to yourself and then came out to others, and that you were rejected largely by, well, entirely, it sounds like, from that community and from the people who you knew and your friends and your family. An inconceivable experience. I can't begin to imagine what it was like for you. But tell us a little bit about what you were hearing from folks that led to the disillusion of those relationships.
I think what I was hearing was people responding to gay as a label. And in the particular community that I was a part of at that time, and this is specifically the church community, because my family was much more hospitable and welcoming. Within the church community, there was a sense that gay was bigger than the person standing in front of me. Being gay was a label that was associated with X, Y, and Z bad things, and therefore I can forget what I know about Obi, the teenager who's growing into being a pastor and he's doing these things. My identity, which I had fought for years, when I finally come to terms with that, and accepted God's acceptance of me, I then had to invite others to adopt that position as well. And for too many people, that was a bridge too far. So I heard things along the lines of, God could never be pleased with you. You can't be happy. You could not be happy in this way, which just, that was counter to my own experience. I knew that I was no longer depressed when I came out and stopped hiding from myself. I knew that I was not, cut off from human life. I didn't feel like a second-class citizen anymore. I had more of an identity of myself, and I had people in my corner, like my grandmother and like my mother and my grandfather as well, who's saying, yes, of course you can be gay and be a Christian. Of course you can. And they were the ones who really showed me that I could hold these parts of my calling and my identity together.
So I'm interested, you know, before we get into, because I think people can anticipate the kinds of questions or premises that I would level as a more traditional Christian when it comes to the issue of homosexuality and marriage. So rather than just skip straight to that, I'm interested in how you deal with, because obviously you've got tons of experience dealing with different scriptural passages, the description of homosexuality as an abomination in scripture, the characterization of, in Romans, I believe it is, talking about how you're not going to be part of the kingdom of God if you engage in these behaviors. Talk us through, and as concise a manner as you can, how you interpret these passages and how you deal with the interpretations of others of these passages, and reconcile all that into being a pastor who guides others through what you interpret to be Christ's vision for their life.
Sure. Very simple. It should take less than 15 seconds or so. Yeah. I teach a Bible study every week, and I lead people in the Bible study to grappling with and engaging biblical texts very seriously, and looking at what's on the page in front of us, and what's the meaning behind it, and the communities that it has served and from which it comes and bears witness to, and finally the God that we see through this text. I have come to realize that to hold the Bible and the words of the Bible in such high esteem that they block the image, recognizing the image of God in someone else, is to make the Bible your God and to make the Bible an idol rather than God's own self. So the Bible is a window through which we look at and we recognize God. The Bible bears witness to how people of faith have followed and understood God for thousands of years, but the Bible is not ultimately God. The Bible is a window through which we recognize Jesus, who is the most faithful example of God's will and God's presence, indeed is God's very self on earth with us. And so where my life and the lives of those in my community are seeking to follow Christ and to bear witness to love and the love of God and love of neighbor, which Jesus said is the highest fulfillment of the law, that is, that's the measure by which I want to be measured, not whether or not I live up to every one of the verses in each corner of the Bible, no matter where you look to find them, because there's a lot in there.
So the way I want to approach this is, first of all, acknowledging that in my view, there has been an abuse of gay people by the evangelical community, by people who identify as Christian. I don't think there's any question of that. I think that the reason why that has happened is the same reason why minority groups historically have always been the targets of abuse and various degrees of oppression, and it's because they're easy targets. And in the context of Christianity, and I might be losing some of my Christian listeners right now, but trust me, I'll come back around to stuff you guys are agreeing with here pretty quick. I think that the reason for that, in particular, why gay people are present vulnerable targets to that type of abuse, is because, unlike so many other categories of sin, and for the sake of this argument, we're gonna accept the biblical premise, or at least present the biblical premise of homosexuality as sin. The various other types of sin are concealable. Like, I am a deeply sinful person, and I am aware of the ways in which I'm a sinful person, but the rest of the world isn't necessarily aware of it. I don't wear it on my sleeve, right? Like, I'm not going around. My identity isn't rooted in what is perceived to be sinfulness. Whereas with homosexuality, the identity itself is associated with a sin against God relative to a traditional interpretation of the Bible. Therefore, it kind of stands out as this target that you can be like, aha, see that person over there. And they become like a lightning rod of let's shame them because they're right out there in the open, and therefore misdirect any sort, or to direct away from ourselves any sort of scrutiny that might be due us regarding the sins in our lives that are not as apparent or not as obvious.
I also think there's a significant amount of social signaling that happens amongst evangelicals to point at people who are gay to misdirect away to say those people are ostentatiously bad, to deflect away from some of the things that they may be doing in their own life that they want to redirect. It's like, look over there, don't look over here. You know, and I think that happens a lot. That's how humans are. We point at other people.
Absolutely. There's no question. And that's always been a problem. You know, you told your story about growing up in a very peculiar religious community. I also grew up in a peculiar religious community that was dominated, you know, it was Jehovah's Witnesses, dominated by hypocrisy and overbearing authoritarianism and very quick triggers on labeling people as irreconcilable sinners who needed to be cast out and, you know, fed to, you know, treated like lepers from the community and what have you. And so this mentality is something that I'm familiar with. What interests me, however, is the potential that we throw the baby out with the bathwater when rather than calling into question the ways in which people approach the presence of sin in the lives of those around them, we try to reinterpret something that is described as sinful in Scripture as not being sinful. And I wonder, and you know, I'm leaving you with a healthy 30 seconds here to respond, and we'll come back on the other side of the break and we continue to expound upon it. But I'm wondering how you arrive at the because I assume you don't regard homosexuality to be a sin, or maybe that's a question worth asking. Do you regard homosexuality to be a sin by your reading of Scripture, and how do you reconcile that characterization of it with your identity as a Christian and as a pastor?
I would say the biblical texts that come to us from 3,000, 2,000 years ago are pretty clear that homosexuality is a sin according to those texts. I do not believe that means that homosexuality is a sin. That means that these texts and those who wrote them thousands of years ago thought that, but they also thought that men should be able to marry as many women as they wanted to, and they also thought that God willed the destruction of the enemy's infant children. Those texts are also in the Bible. And so I learned to separate the Bible as a window to God from the God known in Jesus by whom I seek to measure my life and whom I seek to live up to. That's the measure. And so I would say I don't believe that homosexuality is a sin.
All right. When we come back on the other side, we will expound upon that and get into a biblical perception from the conservative and progressive perspectives of what marriage is and what marriage looks like and what the biblical purpose of marriage even is. And we'll take your phone calls at 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. In studio with me, Pastor Nathan Roberts, Pastor O.B. Bollinger. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right, we're going to try to cram a whole lot into a very short segment here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. In studio with me, Pastors Nathan Roberts and O.B. Bollinger. And we're talking about gay marriage. O.B. is a gay pastor. I played a significant role in the effort to defeat the 2012 amendment that would have codified in the state constitution the ban on gay marriage, and then went on to, just 6 months later, legalize that institution. It is now, as we were talking about during the break, settled law, and not just settled law, like settled culturally. Like we're not going back at this point. And so we're talking about that. And, you know, what's particularly interesting to me is talking about it in terms of, you know, Christian theology and how Christians think about this. Because I think for a lot of our listeners, and certainly for me, the concept of a gay pastor is, you know, I react to it the way I imagine a lot of people reacted to me when I was a Black Tea Partier back in 2008. They're like, what? How does that work, right? And to hear your accounting for that, and that you have a way of looking at Scripture that is trying to get after and you know, maybe I'm misinterpreting it here, but you're trying to get after the character and nature of God, who God actually is, and that you see that as being reflected somewhat beneath the surface or parallel to the text and how the text has been interpreted, and that activity that was regarded has been regarded as sinful traditionally throughout the history of Christianity has been the result of misinterpretation. That's fascinating to me. What's also interesting to me and worth talking about is the purpose of marriage, the biblical purpose of the institution of marriage, why it was instituted, what it's meant to symbolize, and the theological nature of it. And just to what I want to do is try to encapsulate, because this is going to be a very short segment, encapsulate my perception of the conservative perception of what marriage is supposed to accomplish within a Christian context, and then kind of get your response and get your thoughts. And so, to my mind, marriage serves as a model of the reconciliation that Christ is getting after throughout the course of history. You know, we talk about this concept of redemptive history, the notion that the sin entered into the world and created the separation between God and man, and created the necessity for reconciliation, and the means through that reconciliation was the incarnation of Christ and the atoning sacrifice on the cross, the payment of sin, you know, belief, and the reestablishment of relationship, and the fidelity of that relationship. The first commandment of the ten in the Mosaic law, you know, you shall have no other gods but me. That seems to be, without question in my view, what God is primarily getting after. I am your husband, so to speak. I am your love. I am your first and only love. I am due your worship. I am due your praise. I am due your prayer. I am due your respect and your reverence. You shall bow to no other gods. And marriage serves as a model of that type of reconciliation whereby, you know, when we talk, another unpopular word nowadays, when we talk about the submission of the wife to the husband, that is a concept that obviously has been abused throughout history. But in a biblical sense, submission to Christ is not abusive. Like, Christ doesn't abuse us, right? Like, Christ is our loving, thoughtful, providing, caring, correct husband who is not going to do us wrong. And so to submit to him is not to set aside our own well-being in order to service him in some sort of selfish way, but rather to submit ourselves for our own good to the source of our well-being, which is Christ. And, you know, human marriage between human men and human women doesn't always work out that way, obviously, but that is what you're trying to get after. As a husband, you know, I would be in the wrong to try to dominate my wife. But what I am trying to do, what I am seeking after, is to be Christ-like in the sense of providing for her and loving her and doing right by her. And if I succeed in doing those things, then her side of the relationship will mesh and work out to the mutual good of both of us. And so, you know, the in that sense, you know, marriage is our earthly model for our relationship with Christ. It's the means by which we perpetuate the family. It's this foundational unit upon which civilization is based. And those are the sentiments that drove the passion of folks in opposition to gay marriage, because I think the bluntness of it, the bluntness of, we're going to expand the definition to include same gender, the degradation of the marital relationship. Like, I don't think people thought of marriage in terms like I just described it. I think that description had been eroding for years, decades, in the divorce rate being 50% or whatever the case may be. The general disregard for fidelity and the concept of being true to your spouse is something that obviously hasn't been a cultural norm for quite some time. But much like when we talked about the fact that it's easy to marginalize and to castigate homosexuals within the context of the church, because their sin is right out there in the open versus the rest of us who are able to easily hide it. In a similar sense, when the movement started to arise to legalize gay marriage, it was almost like an alarm bell. It was like a trigger where people said, well, this far, no further, right? Like this is the Rubicon that shall not be crossed. And it created this scenario whereby gay people became scapegoats for all the ways in which the rest of us have failed the institution of marriage, and as Christians had failed our Savior and Lord Jesus Christ.
Well, I think there's some truth there to the way that gay folks bore the brunt of what ought to have been more self-reflection and more was antagonism towards an other that we can focus on and say, pay attention over there, then I don't have to worry as much about what I'm doing. You know, when we were looking, marriage success, if you would say it that way, marriage success rates have gone up since gay folks have joined the institution of marriage. Divorce rates are lower now than they were when we had marriage equality, when we won marriage equality. Divorce rates among same-sex couples tend to be lower than among heterosexual couples. So we're trying to do our best to live into this institution. I was struck by the way you described your marriage, Walter. Your marriage is a place where you seek to show love, to provide, to do for your wife and to care for her and to build her up so that she can be the best that she can be. That's exactly what I try to do as a husband too. I don't see a difference between what I try to do in my marriage than what you try to do in your marriage. I believe that the foundational purpose of marriage is to be a place of love, affirmation, abundance. One of my core verses that I come back to is when Jesus says, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." God doesn't want us to be groveling and impoverished of spirit. Jesus comes that we might have abundant life. And so the ways that we come fully alive, some of us, it's marriage. And some of us, it's marriage with a person of the same sex. That's the invitation and the discipline and the responsibility and the challenge to be that caring person, to be that loving provider. And that doesn't need a gender. Doesn't need a difference of gender.
Pastor Obi Bollinger in with us talking about his experience as a pastor and as a gay man. Pastor Nathan Roberts also in studio with us. Late for a break. We will take your calls. We'll talk to Chris and Tony when we return. My name's Walter Hudson. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Truly fascinating conversation with our in-studio guests, Pastor Nathan Roberts and Pastor Obi Bollinger. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing Argument is the name of the program, 651-989-5855. Brad Omland taking your calls and producing the show. Let's talk to Chris in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program. Chris, how's it going? Thanks for holding.
Hey, I didn't say it was Chris from Minneapolis. I said someone else because I'll be ostracized. But anyway,
I'm on you, Chris.
dude, wow, I don't know where to start. The reason the gay marriage thing went through is because people got tricked by the wording. And I know a bunch of people that thought they were voting against gay marriage when they said no.
Really? I have not heard that.
My mom did it. She was voting against gay marriage, but she ended up voting against the ban. And okay, I grew up Lutheran. You can't be a gay pastor. You can't. You just can't. It's against everything that the Lutheran religion stands for. And
actually, the largest Lutheran denomination.
You got the ELCA. It's kind of the fly-by-night Christians. But then you got the Missouri Synod. And that's more strict. I don't know. The pastor grew up in a cult, so he's screwed from the beginning. His mind is not right.
All right, Chris, I appreciate your perspective. How much of that do you want to respond to, Obi?
It's all good. I mean, Chris has got... Chris, I encourage you to come out as who you truly are, because I have found it to be truly liberating and joyful to own my identity. So when you get a chance, Chris from Minneapolis, let us know who you are, and I promise it's a better thing.
Well, there you go. All right, let's talk to Tony in Mendota Heights. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Walter. Intriguing conversation. Thank you guys for having it. You know, when I struggled with the whole vote in 2012, and what I resorted to, and what I do quite often is not the literal text of the Old Testament or even the other books of the Bible. When Jesus died, the curtains were set in the temple to rip, signifying, you know, change from the old and into the new. And if you study the teachings of Jesus, he doesn't really comment at all on the matter. And the bottom line is marriage, from a societal perspective, it makes individuals who participate in it honestly better people. And that being said, I do think one of the reasons why a lot of conservatives struggled with this and continue to do, at least on a political level, is because they feel like there is a broader agenda at play.
Right.
You know, if you have this ideology where the individual can basically come up with their own morality for themselves, it's just a slippery slope. I mean, if somebody is born an alcoholic, right, a lot of addicts and alcoholics say they're born that way.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you encourage them to take part in that particular activity. It actually means that you need to reform away from it. You know, and the slippery slope goes to, you know, the transgender issue and some of the conflicts that arise from that. And I think even realistically, and maybe this is outrageous, but you even see, and it's been happening for a while in academia, cases that are made, and albeit they may be on the fringes, but for pedophiles, you know, people who maybe were born that way or they had early experiences that twisted their attractions and whatnot. But you've seen academia justify pedophilia. And so my question is for the pastors on a broader level, like where do you teach your people to draw the line in terms of what's your own interpretations of who you are versus what is, in fact, you know, Jesus's teachings, God's law? And to take that one step further, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but I'm just curious if this, also your beliefs in say like the issue of abortion, like are you pro-choice as well? That's one of the things that I struggled with is some of my friends who were strongly for gay marriage, which I could accept, but you know, then when I talk to them about broader issues, it just see deep conflicts where I don't agree you know, with their philosophy and whatnot. So I think that's what shies people away from jumping on board totally.
Yeah.
In terms of supporting that.
I want to give Obi an opportunity to respond. I appreciate your comment, Tony. Let me reframe his, because he shoehorned a lot of stuff in there. To reframe it, I would ask it this way, by what standard or what can you provide an example of a hard and fast rule or a biblical standard? You know, how do you derive biblical standards in a way that makes sense consistently but allows for the interpretation that you've taken on homosexuality and gay marriage?
Sure. I keep coming back to what Jesus was asked when he was asked to sum it all up, when he was asked to look at the whole measure of the law, and he said, love God and love your neighbor. This is the foundation. On this hang all the law and the prophets. Love God and love your neighbor as you love yourself. That's what I teach my congregation and my community. That is the Jesus ethic that we live out. And so I take that into, and I pair that alongside what I mentioned earlier about Jesus saying, I've come to give abundant life. I believe that the path to love is that which helps us come alive, helps us live abundantly and joyfully and with purpose and meaning in our lives. So I would ask, and this I got from my own teachers in the Bible and my mentors in faith, does what you're doing, does it build up love? Does it bring you joy, and does it not cause harm to others? Because to cause harm would be to break the law of love. And so that's why I see marriage equality, my marriage and others like it, as an example of love in action, and why I wouldn't obviously say the same for pedophilia.
All right. There's so much we could delve into theologically and deeper conceptually into that question. Unfortunately, we just don't have the time for it. We're going to go to our last break of the evening, and when we come back, I want to kind of wrap things up and particularly focus on, you know, how the freedom to disagree and the objective of coexistence. How is it that people who hold polar different opinions on this issue and other issues can nonetheless live in harmony, at least so much as not being at each other's throats physically and endangering each other and keeping each other from pursuing their values? 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atzin, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right, we got to try to make the best of about 6 minutes here to close out the program tonight. It's been a fascinating conversation with Pastors Nathan Roberts and Obi Bollinger. During the break, you were talking about the effort to legalize gay marriage as one. You described it in a very provocative sense as an effort by gay people to join a conservative institution, and thereby to, in your view, strengthen it. And to say, look, we want to have the promise that marriage is, which is, you know, lifelong commitment, affirming each other, taking care of each other. This model of the reconciling relationship between God and man and what have you. It's interesting because I can tell you for a fact, and this comes as no surprise to you, I'm sure, that that's not at all how anybody perceived it. That's not at all anybody.
You didn't get that message?
I did not get that. And the having been on the other side politically of that issue and tangential issues, the perception has been, and to a large degree, you know, this conversation notwithstanding, I'll be honest with you, my perception remains that the effort around LGBT issues is less about enabling people who identify as such to live their lives according to their own values, which is something that I fundamentally support. As a libertarian and as a Christian, I fundamentally support the idea of individuals living their lives according to their own values. That it's much less about that and much more about seizing the club of the state to force cultural acceptance of something that through a natural relational process would not otherwise be accepted. And you see this play out in terms of anti-discrimination law. You see it pan out in terms of the kind of the shaming and the, you know, let's get people fired. Let's you know, close people's businesses. You know, let's attack people for holding opinions that we disagree with. And so what I want to end our conversation with here tonight is a consideration of how do we coexist? You know, because tonight's conversation notwithstanding, there is going to continue, as shockingly as it may seem, there is going to continue to be disagreement on this issue. And there's going to continue to be disagreement on the Christian interpretation of marriage, the political interpretation of marriage, the political, what we do politically with homosexuality and theologically with homosexuality. How do we coexist in a way that enables people, regardless of the position that they hold, to pursue their values and to conduct their relationships according to consent, without being kept from that which they are due by their human nature.
I think a big piece of that is having discussions. I think one thing that was really great about the marriage amendment movement was that it was a hearts and minds campaign. People were knocking on people's doors, meeting their neighbors, talking to people, sharing their stories. There wasn't this attack mode online. There wasn't, let's try to get people fired. There wasn't, let's ambush people and try to get them to say things that are homophobic and then put it online. And these shame and blame tactics that have begun to dominate public discourse were not as operative in that movement. And I don't know if it was earlier in the internet, and maybe that we kind of missed that. But I do think that as definitions change, it does take some time to get people's head around a new definition of a word or a term that has come to define their place in the world, whether it be marriage, gender, sexuality, sexual orientation. When you change a definition like that, it's going to take a little while to get people's minds around that. And you have to sit with them. And I think if they say something that's not exactly right, or they're in process of changing, blaming and shaming them throughout the way is not helping that transformation. And acknowledging that some people aren't going to change, lashing out at them and blaming, shaming, how does that make for a good society?
Obi, you've got about 40 seconds or so to wrap things up.
We agreed with the work on the marriage campaign to not do the blame and shame, but to give people space to change their minds and to live in humility. And I guess that's where I would end. I preach on, and most folks of faith, Christian faith or Jewish faith, might have read the part in the prophet Micah who says, what does God require of you? Do justice, love kindness or mercy, and walk humbly with your God. I think that what we need more of in this country right now, especially, is that humility, is that peace to say, this is how I'm called to live, and I'm gonna get to know the person across the table from me, and I'm gonna look for the image of God in them, and I'm gonna live with humility while I'm seeking justice, while I'm loving kindness.
It takes humility to have a conversation of a very difficult topic, or on a very difficult topic, across partisan and theological lines, and do so without charging over the table across from each other and trying to throttle each other's throats, which is dominating the way things seem to work online and in the broader discourse. Very much appreciate Nathan Roberts and Obi Bollinger for coming in tonight to facilitate that. We'll continue to talk with you guys. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks
closing
for having
argument.
Us. Thank you.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, twincitiesnewstalk.com.